Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In our last segment, we looked at the case of a notorious rapist and killer who eluded police for decades. And now to a case which has not yet been solved. The crime? The lynching of a prominent black man in the 1950s. A new podcast by Stitcher called Unfinished Deep South explores the 1954 murder of businessman and landowner Isidore Banks and the aftermath. In June 1954, Banks' mutilated body was found in Marion, Arkansas. Here's a scene from Unfinished.
The killing rocked the African-American community. They'd seen lynchings before, but this was different. For much of his life, Isidore's wealth had insulated him. He'd lived 59 years and managed to thrive despite decades of racial terror. So what changed? Why was Isidore killed? And why then?
Unfinished Deep South debuted this week. We spoke with reporter Taylor Hom and producer Stephanie Kariuki about the making of this series. Here is some of that conversation. So we got a little clip of it there, a little sense of it, Taylor. What made Isidore Banks unique?
So we first found out about Isidore in 2017. His name was on a list of unsolved civil rights crimes that the FBI had compiled for potential investigation in 2007. There are 100 names on this list, and Isidore was among them. And by the time we found his name, the case, many of these cases had been opened and closed pretty quickly, and the cases were still unsolved. And he stood out to us for a few reasons. The first was that he had been lynched in 1954. So this is a case that's within living memory. It's not too long ago. He still has a lot of family around, sons, daughters, and there are people in his community who remember him and his story. And so we thought we had a better chance of finding out what happened to him than, say, a case that happened in the early 1900s. And then second, Isidore just seemed like a really fascinating guy. He was 59 years old when he was lynched, and he had managed to survive and thrive in the Jim Crow South as a successful farmer and businessman for many decades. And so on top of this question of what happened to Isidore Banks, who lynched him, there was also the question of what happened to his wealth. Where did that go? So we started digging in, talking to his family, and we realized that they had a lot of the same questions that we did.
So, Stephanie, how had he accumulated so much land and so much wealth as a black man living in the Jim Crow South?
I mean, Isidore, he was able to kind of break through in ways that I feel like are really surprising looking at that time. I mean, he had 1,000 acres of land, and he was a veteran. You know, before that, he was really dedicated to his community, and he lived in Marion, Arkansas, where there was a thriving black population. I mean, Isidore had a ton of land and wealth, but he was surrounded by a black community that were, you know, also doing a lot for their community and being successful by all accounts. So I think what stood out to me most about Isidore is that he was not only able to accumulate this wealth, but he used it to benefit his community in a way that is really fascinating looking at the time, which was in the Jim Crow South.
Well, how did his success put him in danger?
The point of his wealth that we've mentioned so much is, like, not only does that bring him a lot of respect within his black community, but it draws a lot of attention from, you know, the white people in the area as well. I mean, he had wealth that was sometimes outnumbering theirs. And I think that can, even today, draw a lot of attention that might not be wanted. And Isidore definitely was the recipient of that.
My guests are Stephanie Kariuki and Taylor Hom. We're talking about Unfinished Deep South podcast, which drops on June 29th. Mm-hmm. And this may sound like an obvious question, but I would love the clarification for everyone listening. Why was his death considered a lynching, not just a murder?
So,
Taylor, you want to take that?
Yes, this is a complicated question because there's been a lot of, you know, fighting over this, the definition of what a lynching actually is. But one scholar that we talked to, a professor at Northeastern named Margaret Burnham, she put it very well when she said, we should know who killed Isidore Banks. He was a prominent citizen. It was the powers in the county had all of the resources to take on this investigation and do something, and they did absolutely nothing. So
and the terror that it sent through the community also just was very emblematic of what a lynching is meant to do. It's meant to send a message to white people that says, you know, you are white, that matters, you are protected. And it sends a message to the African-American community that says, that is basically terror. And so that's what kind of at the core of the lynching. And it was very clear with Isidore and the timing after Brown v. Board that was, you know, what it was meant to do.
Stephanie, did you want to add anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to remember about lynching is that it replaced slavery as a form in a lot of ways to destroy Black lives, in the same way that you would see mass incarceration would do later in the 70s and 80s. So it creates ripple effects within a community when one happens. You know, folks are scared to talk about it. There's a message that lynchings are like, you don't want this to happen to you. And it just spreads within a community in a way that I think is really pervasive and creates a lot of silence and fear.
Taylor, it's a cold case, and as you're investigating this lynching of Isidore Banks, you have to go through some files, and you found just a mess. Would you describe what going through the files in Marion were like, what that experience was like?
Yeah, and I think this is a common experience in courthouses throughout the country. It was just old, big, musty books that, you know, hadn't been touched in decades. Pages were falling out. You can barely read anything. So there was just a lot of digging to do, and it was frustrating at times, but we had a lot of people helping us, and we spent a lot of time in that basement. So we were able to find some things, and there were also people that had, you know, taken to this courthouse to try to figure out what kind of land Isidore had and where before us. So we had work to build off of, which was really helpful, and we were very grateful for.
I'm curious. I once was working on a story in Arkansas, and we went into like a Flying J, you know, those truck stops. And one of the guys I was with was wearing like a Izod and a pink sweater. And the guy behind the counter said, "How far north and how far east are you from anyway?" So, which I've never forgotten. So what was the reaction in town when you guys started to show up and poke around?
Well, at first people were, you know, confused. The town has grown a lot since Isidore's time. So there's a lot of newcomers that just had no idea who he was. And so there was definitely a sense of like, what are you guys talking about? Why are you here? It's a small town. So just like, why are these two journalists spending so much time in this courthouse basement? But then there was also, you know, a lot of interest in the African-American community, particularly Isidore's story and his person has survived as this kind of myth and legend. People would drive us around and point and say, that's Isidore Banks' land, or that's where Isidore Banks used to have the cotton gin. So just learning about him through this, the way that his memory had been passed down through generations was really interesting.
We're talking about the new podcast, Unfinished Deep South. I'm talking to the creative team of Stephanie Karaoke, producer, and Taylor Holm, the reporter. So Taylor, you know, you mentioned the family and some of the people in the Black community were very interested when you folks hit the ground. What about white folks in Marion, particularly older white folks? What did they think of you poking around?
Yeah, I mean, so there was obvious tendencies and patterns. There were some white people that, you know, were willing to talk to us and be like, here's what I heard, for what it's worth. This is what I know, and good luck with your investigation. But there were a number of white folks that just didn't want anything to do with us. It almost felt like they were annoyed with us for bringing up this case. And so we had a lot of hangups. We had a lot of, it's of course the South, so people are still very polite, just being like, I don't want anything to do with this, and I'm not going to offer you any information. And you know, that kind of silence and complicity was very frustrating, and you know, it still resonates today. And with the white people that did talk to us and did remember Isidore, their memory of him was very different than an African American community. They remembered him mostly just for the way in which he was killed. They didn't know much about him at all. They didn't know he'd been a landowner or a businessman. They didn't know what he looked like. Those basic details of personhood, it wasn't in their recollection of Isidore Banks. It was mostly the details around his lynching that they knew him for. So that really stood out.
And And I just want to add to that, that I think that piece is really important because it adds to the erasure bit that we talk a little bit on the podcast.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, whenever there's a tying to, when a lynching happens, automatically, like, that black body is tied to the violent way that they died. And I think that, you know, a lot of people often just associate their death with the way that they lived, and that's frankly like a way to erase like black stories, which is something that we definitely go into.
And you know, it's listening, I've only heard the first three episodes, I can't wait for the rest, I'm now obsessed, but you can't, in this moment, you can't not think about everything that's going on in terms of police violence and uneven policing of communities of color, because in this story, we don't give too much away, there is this sheriff in town, Sheriff Cecil, who has got so much power. What was his power like, and how did it shape the town of Marion and people's lives?
So when we started digging into Isidore's case, one of the first things we heard was that his wealth might have been taken by the sheriff of the county. And so we started digging into that, and the amount of power that the sheriff and then the police had was just really stunning to us. You know, this is the era of Jim Crow, so the sheriff is the enforcer of white supremacy, which is not only like codified law, but it's also these social understandings of how, where you walk and how you talk and who you can talk to and what doors you go through. So on top of that, he also controls voting, and then he controls the taxes. So he's controlling the records that are in the courthouse. The people that also, the sheriff was part of a machine, a democratic machine that ran the county. And these guys also own the newspaper. So just that kind of monopoly over all the levers of power was just really stunning to us. And you can the stories of the violence and the coercion and the corruption, just with having that many levers, was just really all encompassing.
Stephanie, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of power that, you know, there was the Voting Rights Act that was eventually passed, and it changed, you know, some of that, what we would see in Cecil Goodwin's case. But I will say, like, in its relevance to today, like, you see that our systems are just able to shapeshift in a way that, even though the sheriff might not have as much power, but you might see like a prosecutor, you know, for example, who has a lot of power. The thing that I just like to remember and that I like to tie to today is just that oftentimes, although systems may change, they can often shapeshift and can be deceivingly dangerous.
That was my conversation with reporter Taylor Hom and producer Stephanie Karaoke about the new podcast, Unfinished Deep South.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.